Andy and Anna here from your new favorite podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
Yes, we are two of the four hosts of the podcast that stuffs fascinating, amazing, weird, mad facts into your ears on a weekly basis. You got any good facts, Andy?
Yes, how about this one? Anteaters have evolved on 12 separate occasions.
Wow.
Mysterious. Wonderful.
The world really wants them to exist. What about this one? When Ronald Reagan left office, he left a note on the White House lawn for the squirrels, warning them to beware of George Bush's dogs.
So there you go. If you like fascinating facts and much more besides, we are No Such Thing as a Fish.
Thank you to Rula for sponsoring this episode. What came next is intended for mature audiences only. Episodes discuss topics that can be triggering, such as emotional, physical, and sexual violence, animal abuse, suicide, and murder. I am not a therapist, nor am I a doctor. If you're in need of support, please visit somethingwaswrong.com/resources for a list of nonprofit organizations that can help. Opinions expressed by my guests on the show are their own and do not necessarily represent the views of myself or Broken Cycle Media. Resources and source material are linked in the episode notes. Thank you so much for listening. Jen Walenta is a mother, survivor, educator, dancer, and advocate. After pursuing a degree in contemporary dance, Jen reinvented her career several times to evolve with her burgeoning family. However, her trajectory would forever change in 2015 when she found a folder of videos on her husband at the time's computer. The videos inside the folder showed her an alternate reality to the one she was living in, and life as she knew it changed forever. As a result, she would eventually seek justice within the criminal legal system and cultivate her own sense of justice outside of it. This led her to begin vulnerably sharing her experiences in her social media-based series, Tiny Kitchen Dances, which then led to the making of her documentary, Tiny Movements. The Broken Cycle Media team is so grateful that Jen was willing to share her story so powerfully and eloquently for the sake of our audience's awareness.
Hi, I'm Jen Walenta. I am so many things. I think the thing I'm proudest of being is a mama to my two kiddos. But I'm also a lifelong educator and dancer. So those are the ways I would describe myself. If you asked my friends, if you asked my family who I am, many different answers you would get. I'm the oldest of six children. My siblings jokingly say I'm the judgy one. I have a lot of opinions. I try to be kind about them. I try to ask questions more than judge. My children would say I'm the mayor of every town and street I walk down. Ever since they were little, they would say, "Mama, please don't talk for 30 minutes to every person you meet. We want to go home." And these days, I'm often described by my friends and loved ones as something to do with light. I'm often spoken about in terms of a disco ball, in terms of shining brightly and continuing to share that light even when the darkness is present. I was born in Ogden, Utah. My family's not Mormon. I get asked that a lot. My dad worked for the IRS as a computer programmer. Then my parents, after my younger brother was born, they moved across the country to New Hampshire to work at a group home for troubled teens. Very interesting organization that still exists, actually. The caretakers and their families lived with the teens, and it was a really beautiful community. I remember, even though I was so young, my third sibling was born there. Shortly after she was born, my parents decided it was time to move again, but they weren't sure where they wanted to go. So they bought a 12-passenger van and outfitted it to live in. So we were like original van lifers. They built a cabinet behind the driver's seat where my younger brother and I had two little sleeping bags that rolled up, and we would sleep with our feet under the cabinet and our heads towards the sliding door back when vans only had one sliding door. And the baby would sleep with my parents in the bed that folded out across the bench seats in the back. We traveled across the country for about 9 months. I have beautiful memories of that time camping, and in true 5-year-old fashion, I told some old lady that I didn't have a home, and she gave me money and a stuffed animal. It was a great day. My parents ended up coming back south to Asheville, North Carolina. They both grew up in Tennessee and Memphis and Nashville, and they felt that Asheville was kind of equidistant between their families and the beautiful mountains, and the ocean was not so far away, so we could visit. I was homeschooled, really unschooled. My mother was a devotee of John Holt, who wrote a book about unschooling. I and my siblings did not do a lot of what people might call traditional book learning. I read voraciously. I never left the house with less than 2 books, which I now understand is a certain form of hypervigilance as well. I loved reading, all of my siblings and I did. And we were all really close. My family was very interesting. My mother in particular had really strong ideals for raising children, but struggled with the follow through. I'm being kind, which I try to be, and without telling every part of the story, we were essentially benignly neglected. Lucky for us, we lived in community. We're kind of swooped up at different times, but there was a lot of things that were not so good. My parents divorced, and then all of us went to public school for the first time. I didn't really fit in, which was okay and also tricky. There was grooming and sexual abuse by men in the community that I experienced. I can look at now and see how that is a part of my larger story. I left home at 17 after being accepted into a professional dance school program. In the dance world, we would say probably that I was very classically trained. I had a lot of ballet and I did a lot of very classical contemporary dance. And for my senior year of high school, the local church that we had been a part of, I had danced there since I was 10 years old. They raised the money for me to go away my senior year of high school. In lots of ways, that was the beginning of dance being a part of what saved me. I went off to North Carolina School of the Arts, which is a very unique and beautiful school and program. It's about 2 hours from Asheville, North Carolina, in Winston-Salem. I was finally really safe and I had agency. It was small agency, right? It's like going off to college, but I took everything I owned with me, which of course wasn't a whole lot. And I didn't understand when I did that, I was leaving home. I didn't have home to return to. I remember that people came with their dorm things. And of course they were going home for breaks and Christmas, and mom and dad were going to send them money and care packages, etc. And I really got a reflection there that I was living a very different experience than some. Depending on the arts program you're in, there are high school programs, which is what I went for. It's also a college. It's a part of the University of North Carolina system. The time I was there, there were just about 1,000 of us. I was a high school student, but half of my classmates were college students. It's kind of like a mixed age kindergarten for people who are a little bit older in some ways, which relates to my work in early childhood. And we find in those mixed age kindergartens, there is space for the younger, less experienced to learn from those who are older and more experienced. On the opposite end, the older, more experienced is able to be in a role of modeling and supporting. When I went to School of the Arts, we were all the weird kids. We were all the art kids. We were all the theater kids. I would not say I was one of the cool kids, but I absolutely felt at home and like I had a sense of belonging. So I stayed. It's a very competitive program to get into. So to give an idea, in 1996, when I was accepted into the program, there were 40 of us from high school to college. When I graduated in 2001, there were 8 of us. There are things I can say that I wish had been different, had been more holistic, more supportive of a young person, a young dancer, body, heart, and soul. But largely, my experience was beautiful and supportive. And so many of the people that I met in that time are still some of my dearest friends. I was never the best dancer. I was never the dancer with the highest legs or the most pirouettes or the first one chosen when the guest artist would come. But I always worked hard. I always cared. I always showed up. I was always honest in my work. I often hear, don't go to art school. Why would you go get a degree in dance, etc.? And I say to people, if it doesn't just burn like fire in your soul, no, don't do that. It needs to burn like fire in your soul. And you need to also have the understanding that you are going to have to be creative. You are going to have to think outside of the box. You are likely not going to be the penultimate dancer, but you are going to be yourself, and it is going to inform, if you allow it, every part of your life in the most beautiful fashion. I, in the summers, would stay and work on campus and live on campus for lots of reasons. As I said, I didn't really have a home to return to. This was the summer before my senior year. We were getting ready. We were sitting in the office. I had the list of everyone working, and I knew everyone who had been hired except one person. And I was like, who is this Chris person? And I asked my good friend Mike, who was part of the same design and production technical theater program. And he's like, oh, Chris, he's this really tall guy, got piercings and tattoos. You don't know who that is? And I didn't. I remember I'm sitting in the office, in walks this very handsome, shaved head. He's wearing a white tank top and big 90s jeans. He had his eyebrow pierced. He had both his ears pierced. And you could see through the tank top, he had his nipples pierced. And I remember looking at him and thinking, wow, this is a very good looking guy. Also kind of a quote unquote bad guy. And I was very much the quote unquote good girl. I was immediately taken in by him.
Thank you to Rula for sponsoring this episode. Over the last 3 years, we have amplified hundreds of trauma survivors on What Came Next, and one of the most common coping mechanisms survivors have reported using in their journey is talk therapy. Sometimes what comes next isn't about having all the answers. It's about having the right support while you figure things out. Finding a therapist can be a huge hurdle, though. And finding one who actually takes your insurance? That's where most online therapy platforms fall short. But Rula does things differently. They partner with over 100 insurance plans, making the average copay just $15 per session. That's real therapy from licensed professionals at a price that actually makes sense. And Rula isn't just affordable. The experience is tailored around you. Rula considers your goals, preferences, and background to provide you a curated list of licensed in-network therapists who are aligned with what you need and the therapy that you require, because they know that finding the right therapist can make all the difference. To add, there are no wait lists, no frustrating back and forth, because Rula makes it easy to find a mental health provider who is accepting new patients. And appointments are available as soon as tomorrow. Plus, Rula sticks with you throughout your journey, checking in to make sure your care is helping you move forward. Go to Rula.com/WCN to get started today. Thousands of people are already using Rula to get affordable, high-quality therapy that's actually covered by insurance. Just visit Rula.com/WCN to get started. That's Rula.com/WCN. You deserve mental health care that works with you, not against your budget.
This is a Wednesday in June in the year 2000, and I remember real specifics around it for a few reasons. One, I kept a diary for a very long time, and I actually have diary entries from these days. 2, it was the Wednesday before my 21st birthday. My friends were making plans to take me out. I was just so excited because that night we were going to all go out to the bar, and I was so much the good girl that I had not had more than like a sip of somebody's wine. And so it was a big deal to go out and have a real drink on my 21st birthday. The student activities crew, we all went out to the local bar, which was right down the street from my apartment. And Chris came, of course. He was going outside to smoke cigarettes, which I thought was disgusting and also kind of sexy. Chris actually was flirting with this girl across the bar and was going to walk her home. And I was full on in my birthday queen day. And I looked at my friend Kyle and I said, I want him to come back. So Kyle said, okay, you can walk that girl home, no problem. But also you have to come back, it's Jen's birthday. So give me your keys and give me your cigarettes. So Chris gave him all those things. He walked this woman home and came back. And then we took the party to my apartment. I have pictures of us at the bar on that night, of Chris and I together. I had a big crush on him at this point, 3 days in. I'm leaning up against him, slightly tipsy, maybe even a lot tipsy, post first 21st birthday drinks. He ended up staying the night because I asked him to. He slept next to me, but nothing happened. I remember him saying to me, we're not going to do anything because you're drunk, and that wouldn't be right. So that's a real piece of my story, actually, with him. He was this really good guy. He was really kind. He was really aware. He would never take advantage of anyone. I know him pretty well, for better and for worse. And when I look back at those early days, people say, well, were there red flags? Yes, there were some things that I would now term love bombing, but I don't think it was intellectualized. It wasn't premeditated. From that moment on, we were attached at the hip, really, in what I felt like was the sweetest way. I really hadn't dated anyone. I was not a person who hooked up with people. Part of my story, Chris is the first person I had a consensual sexual relationship with. I had had abuse in my life as a young teen and into my late teen years. To be very specific, I had not had penetrative sexual abuse. So I was a quote-unquote virgin, which I kind of hate that term. I actually think it's a patriarchal term of ownership. But Chris is the first person that I had sex with. And it was beautiful. It was kind. It was, are you okay? Do you want this? Do you like this? And from that point on, we really were together. And this is pre-cell phones, right? So he actually had a pager. We figured out some codes for things. Shortly after, we did get cell phones that had limited use because we wanted to be more connected. Within 6 months, we had moved in together. This is my senior year of college, his junior year of college. Everyone was so happy for me. It was like, wow, this person has shown up, has scooped you in the sweetest way. And that is absolutely not to say that everyone loved Chris. There are lots of people who did not love him personality-wise, etc. But I was happy. I felt belonging. I felt care. I felt seen. So many things that I so deeply wanted seemed to have come with him. Chris was very romantic. He was very good at making dinner for me. He was a good cook. He was good at, you've had a bad day. Hey, let me give you a foot rub. Or why don't you go take a bath? Or what can I do? He loved doing those things in my memory of him. Then I graduated college and it was like, am I going to go to New York? Most people at that point were going to New York. And I was like, this relationship is so beautiful and so good. Actually, I'm going to wait a year. I took a job working for a rural arts council. I was very well paid. They were well funded. I was teaching children and helping run their Nutcracker program and being so happy living with Chris. Then he proposed. We had talked about it. It was like, were so advanced and so grown up. I was 22. So I came home one night and there were candles everywhere. He met me at the door of our apartment and he said, okay, you have to find all of the fake rings and then you'll get the real one. He had created a scavenger hunt. He had gotten the designer of the ring he'd had made for me in his hometown to give him 20 ring boxes. And in each of the ring boxes, he had placed one of those plastic butterfly rings. They're on a little spring. And he'd hidden them around our apartment. And I'm looking and I'm looking and I'm looking. And I find however many I'm supposed to find. I think it was 19 or something I was supposed to find. I've got to find the 20th one or something before I get the real one. And this is so fun for me. It's like, how much more fun could this possibly be? And I'm looking and I'm looking and I turn around and he's on one knee in our hallway. He opens up a box and it's the real ring. And he asks me to marry him. And of course I say yes. Even though I had known this was coming, so to speak, this was the most beautiful, loving, creative, fun, whimsical way I could have been proposed to. So we're engaged. Soon thereafter, he graduates from college and his family all come to celebrate, his grandparents, his sister, his mom and dad. Right after that, I decided it was time for me to move to New York City and to pursue dance professionally, to audition and try it out. We went on a 2-month long road trip, Chris and I, cross country, 8,000 miles in 7 weeks, using our graduation gift money, and we camped the whole way. And part of our joke was, this is how we know that we can get married. We used to tell people, we're such a good match. We love each other so much. Yes, we argue, we have our things, but really, as evidenced by our 2-month long road trip, we only one time looked at each other and walked the opposite direction and said, don't talk to me. So it was a big, beautiful road trip. And then a U-Haul to New York City and some funny New York City kerfuffles before I found an apartment with a friend. And Chris stayed in North Carolina because he'd been offered a scholarship to do graduate school. And so we were engaged but distanced and had planned to get married in 2004. In the winter of 2002/2003, Chris decided that grad school wasn't for him and he was going to go ahead and come to New York. And we thought, why are we waiting to get married then? We were going to wait till you were done with school, but you're not doing school, so let's push it out. And we made plans to get married in September of 2003. We were young New Yorkers with a beautiful creative community, but no money. We figured out how to have the most beautiful wedding in the backyard of the minister's house who officiated. And my very best friend from childhood got married 2 or 3 weeks before we did. And so we actually collaborated together and bought candle holders and things that we could use across both weddings, the things that usually get thrown away. I bought a stamp of a tree of life and I made all of our invitations. Were they fancy calligraphy? No, they were made with love and care on my apartment floor with friends' help. We painted rocks with a tree of life symbol to put on the tables as a gift. My roommate and dear friend is a costume designer, and she made my wedding dress for me. We went down to the fabric district and picked out the most beautiful silk charmeuse, and she fitted it to me in our dining room. I still have that dress. It's so beautiful. People often ask me if I'm going to burn it or do some sort of ceremonial destruction. And I say, no, I was beautiful. And that dress is beautiful. And it was made by a very dear friend of mine. I do have plans to have it altered into a jumpsuit and then dyed by a wonderful artist here in my hometown. I will change it to meet my needs and I will keep it. We got married on September 6th of 2003, the most beautiful day, and danced into the night. And we left 2 or 3 days later for our honeymoon that was a gift from his parents to go to the West Indies, to Anguilla, where he had spent a lot of time in his childhood, actually. His family had lived there for a period of time. So a special place for him. It's the first time I had ever left the country. One of the things Chris brought to me was expansion of view in so many ways. I grew up very poor on government assistance. We ate beans and rice and boxed cheese. So Chris had lived a much more robust, privileged, financially travel-wise life than I had. So not only was I married to this amazing man who loved me with this amazing family who cared for us and was sending us on this beautiful honeymoon, it was the beginning of so much more to come, to build, to participate in as a married couple.
Andy and Anna here from your new favorite podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
Yes, we are two of the four hosts of the podcast that stuffs fascinating, amazing, weird, mad facts into your ears on a weekly basis. You got any good facts, Andy?
Yes, how about this one? Anteaters have evolved on 12 separate occasions.
Wow.
Mysterious. Wonderful.
The world really wants them to exist. What about this one? When Ronald Reagan left office, he left a note on the White House lawn for the squirrels, warning them to beware of George Bush's dogs.
So there you go. If you like fascinating facts and much more besides, we are No Such Thing as a Fish.
We came back from Anguilla and we were in New York and had found an apartment in an up-and-coming neighborhood. I was waiting tables and then I was nannying, going to dance classes and auditions and starting to think about what I wanted to do in the dance world. He was working and starting to find his niche in that world in New York. We were really doing it. Then I really had a kind of come to Jesus moment where I had been trained for a certain kind of eat, sleep, breathe, dance, everything to sacrifice for my art. And I realized I didn't want that. And so I stepped back from dancing and said, you know what? I actually really want to have a baby. And I, gosh, didn't really plan to do that this early. The professional dance world I've been training to be a part of says I'm ruining my career. But my gut instinct says, yes, you should have a baby. And my partner said, yes, let's have a baby. So I went off my birth control pills and was pregnant the next month. And I was so excited. I had a beautiful pregnancy. Chris is making enough money in the union that I'm not freaking out about what will come after the baby comes. And I can mostly be home, hopefully. Zoe was born October 2005. If you're doing the math, that means their 21st birthday is coming up, which is a big deal for all humans. And in my story, because that's when I met Chris, it's a big deal as I think about how my child goes forth in the world as I reflect on how I went forth. So Zoe's born and we are smitten. This incredible, joyful, grinning little beastie that feels like we are on our path completing our family. We then realize we need to make a little more money. He's not really making enough to totally support us. So I'm scrappy and I'm an idealist and I wanted to be home with my baby. So I start babysitting for local babies and families. And I make some of the best friends that I still have. And some of these babies are still friends with my baby, and they're now 20 and 21. I charged less than the nannies were charging who needed to make a full salary because I was bringing my baby with me. And we made it work. And then when Zoe is one, I take a yoga teacher training course, thinking I'm going to teach grownups. And I'm going to start building a yoga clientele. And then I'm contacted by a local friend in the neighborhood who I met through these babysitting groups I was doing. And She's like, I wonder if you might consider teaching a kids yoga class at my son's preschool. So I say, yeah, of course, sure, I can do that. And I made a children's yoga class curriculum. And that's the start of a 10-year business that I ran in New York that I built from the ground up, where I developed children's yoga curriculums and went into preschools and after-school programs. Chris was building his career. I was building my career. Zoe is 2, and we are trying for a second child. And we bought a sweet one-bedroom apartment that we split the bedroom in half and turned it into a 2-bedroom apartment. And a year later, not quite even, my second child was born in that apartment at the foot of our bed. Chris was right there holding my hands as that second incredible human slipped into the world. And our family felt complete and like we had nowhere to go but up. I'm a mama at that point with a budding business that I had wrapped around my children. So I had babysitters that would come and watch them only for my working hours. And I only ever hired a babysitter if I could still be in the black. And I never counted Chris's money. So I was working about 15 or 20 hours a week teaching yoga for children in preschools and parenting full time. Chris was working, and that meant that on average, during busy season, he was working 50 to 80 hours a week. So he really wasn't home. I was the primary caretaker, and we were so proud of us. We had really good health insurance, and Chris was the primary breadwinner, but I was still helping, and the money I brought in meant that we had a comfortable-ish life. We were living on the 6th floor of an apartment building with no direct outdoor space. To remind you all, I grew up in the mountains, barefoot running through the grass. And I realized I was really needing that. And a little bit idealistic, I said, listen, we got to sell this apartment. Even if we rent something that has a balcony, I just need to be able to walk outside. I'm feeling really disconnected. We sold that apartment less than 2 years after buying it at a very decent profit. We had friends in the neighborhood who were selling their house in Brooklyn. They made us a deal. We bought that house in 2010 when my children were turning 5 and turning 2. We had a backyard, and a couple years later, we would get chickens. Meanwhile, the subway, the Q train, ran right behind our house. When I was on the Manhattan-bound train side, my children could come out to the balcony behind our house and they could wave at Mama as I got on the train to go into the city. We called it the Fairy House. It was a cedar shingled house, and I planted all these flowers and vegetables, and it was a magical combination of being in New York City and living in the country. It was just the fairy tale. Zoe is ready for kindergarten, and I wanted to be really intentional about what came for my child as they entered school. I had already helped to start some co-op preschools in the neighborhood. It was like 3 days a week, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, from 9 to noon. We had 6 families involved. So we'd had these little morning preschool groups that we had created. And then it was time for quote unquote real school. We own this house. It's a 2-family house. The downstairs is an apartment that initially we were going to rent out, and it didn't really work out so well. So I was like, why don't we use it for a co-op preschool for my younger child, my son? We can just make a bigger version of that traveling co-op school that we did. We'll hire a teacher and we'll have 2 different groups who come in here. We can give a teacher full-time work. We can pay our bare minimum rent that we need to make our mortgage on this space. And I'm living into my ideals of community and education. There's actually a BBC news document on that preschool that I started. I launched a school. I was running my own teaching business. I had 2 children, one who I'd just put into an independent school that I was figuring out how to pay for to meet my ideals of education for this child. We're squeaking by and doing well and so proud of us. This is 2011. I go to a Sufjan Stevens concert in Prospect Park. I always buy two tickets to concerts, even if I don't have someone who can go with me. That's always been my practice. Get two, find a date, invite someone who maybe you don't hang out with all the time. So I had a neighborhood acquaintance who joined me. She was so excited to come and she's like, oh, I'll just buy the drinks. Now, I am a lightweight when it comes to alcohol. I buy a drink and then I get another one. So like, I know I've had two, like that's enough. And she just kept bringing me wine and I was dancing and it started raining. I mean, it was just an incredible, beautiful sensory experience with this incredible artist playing. And he does a lot of really cool costuming things and had backup dancers. So I got pretty drunk. And on the bus ride home, the woman I was with called Chris and was like, she's a little drunk. Please come meet her at the bus stop to walk her home. We all get a little drunk sometimes and we all take care of each other, right? So Chris came to meet me at the bus stop and walk me the four blocks home. He was kind of joking with me, as I recall, about like I was really loop-de-loop-dee. And we get home. My baby brother was there visiting. Chris pushes me up the stairs. They're all kind of making fun of me because Jen's a lightweight and she got drunk at the concert. Got to put her to bed. Now, I didn't know this until years later, but that is the first night that Chris realized he could take advantage of me. I don't remember what happened that night, but that is the first night. And Chris admits this. That night, that year in particular, there's that pin in the calendar that, of course, I didn't know the pin was in the calendar until 4 years later in 2015 when I found all the videos. He realized I didn't like being drunk, which is when he began trying different medications that he would mix in with a nightcap that he would make me so we could hang out after he'd come home from work and I'd wait up late for him. And how kind of him to make me that drink. I loved that. It was very sweet until it wasn't. So that was 2011. I'm 32. And we go through 2013. I'm teaching 20 hours a week, which is a lot when you're literally face-to-face, physically moving the whole time. It's good, but it's a lot. And I'm full-time parenting these two little people who are now turning 8 and 5. I'm dancing every Wednesday. I'm part of a collaborative group. We perform monthly at a church right outside of Times Square. And I'm tired. But something at that point starts to feel a little off. I don't really have colleagues because I'm an independent teacher going into various preschools, teaching, and then I leave. So Wednesdays, those artistic collaborators become my sounding board and my friends. And I start to say to them, I feel a little funny, like I'm so tired. I feel like I'm losing time. And I'm such an external processor. So I'm saying this, but I don't really know what I mean. I get a lot of care, like, gosh, I'm so sorry. Are you eating well? How is Chris supporting you? Is there anything we can do? And all of my answers are, gosh, Chris is supporting me so well. He's doing all of this care and making sure we have what we need. How lucky am I? I really don't know why I'm tired.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. Next week on What Came Next.
Chris is in the kitchen cooking, and I looked at him and I said, are you giving me something? I had no idea why I said that. I wanted to shove it back into my mouth and pretend it didn't happen. And he looked at me and he said, gosh, thank you for trusting me so much to say something so awful. You must be so tired. You're working so hard. We're stressed out with money. All of these things. He had told me, no, of course I'm not giving you anything. I remember immediately knowing he was lying.
Thank you to Rula for sponsoring this episode. Thousands of people are already using Rula to get affordable, high-quality therapy that's actually covered by insurance. Just visit rula.com/WCN to get started. That's RULA.com/WCN.
What Came Next is a Broken Cycle Media production, co-produced by Amy B. Chesler and Tiffany Reese. If you'd like to help support What Came Next, you can leave us a positive review, support our sponsors, or follow Broken Cycle Media on Instagram at Broken Cycle Media. Check out the episode notes for sources, resources, and to follow our guests. Thank you again for listening.
Andy and Anna here from your new favorite podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
Yes, we are two of the four hosts of the podcast that stuffs fascinating, amazing, weird, mad facts into your ears on a weekly basis. You got any good facts, Andy?
Yes, how about this one? Anteaters have evolved on 12 separate occasions.
Wow.
Mysterious. Wonderful.
The world really wants them to exist. What about this one? When Ronald Reagan left office, he left a note on the White House lawn for the squirrels, warning them to beware of George Bush's dogs.
So there you go. If you like fascinating facts and much more besides, we are No Such Thing as a Fish.